Imagine a city where every building breathes with greenery, where streets hum with the song of birds, and where nature isn't just a backdrop, but an integral part of urban life. Some architects, planners, and ecologists are working to make this vision a reality, united to reshape our cities into thriving ecosystems. From green roofs and living walls to wildlife corridors and biophilic design, the movement is gaining momentum. But what does it mean to design for life? How do we balance human needs with environmental stewardship? And can our cities truly flourish when they harmonize with nature?
Building space around it is not just empty to be filled later with some decorative plants, but rather it's working, functioning landscape for our health.
That was my guest, Nina Marie Lister. I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Spaces, the podcast where we explore the forces that shape our spaces and how they shape us. Thanks for coming back, everybody. In today's episode, we're joined by Professor Nina Marie Lister, a leading expert in ecological design and urban planning. As the director of the Ecological Design Lab at Toronto Metropolitan University, Nina Marie's work connects people and nature through innovative green infrastructure. She is also a senior fellow of Massey College and a visiting professor at Harvard University, where she leads the Wild Ways Project. With numerous accolades, including the prestigious Margulies National Design for Living Prize, Nina Marie's research focuses on designing cities that thrive in harmony with the natural world. We'll explore how ecological design can transform urban spaces for climate resilience, biodiversity recovery, and improve human well-being. Nina Marie shares insights on biophilic cities, the power of nature-based solutions, and how we can rethink urban development for a more sustainable future. And we'll get into all of that after this break. Hi, Demetrius here. As you may know, Spaces is part of Gable Media, the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community and beyond. You may have heard me previously mention the development of a brand new membership platform for Gable Media. Well, it's finally here. You can now sign up to be a member at gablemedia.com/members. And as your first major perk, you gain exclusive access to our continuing education program, including AIA credit-worthy courses. That's right. Gable Media is now an official AIA CES provider, and you can get credit for listening to Select Spaces episodes. The days of scouring the internet for online courses and running around town for credit-worthy presentations are over. I've tried out our program, and it is the most convenient way to get your continuing education credits. Now, this membership tier will be limited, so make sure to go to gablemedia.com/members or just click the link in the show notes to gain access today. Thank you for joining me. To start, tell me a little bit about yourself and what it is that you do. Quick elevator pitch on what you do.
I'm Nina Marie Lister. I'm a professor of ecology and design, and in my lab, we connect people to nature and cities every day.
For those that may not be familiar with this concept of ecology and design, can you kind of break that down a little bit more? And if an alien were to land on the planet, how would you explain it to them?
Well, ecology is everywhere. It's inside you and me. It's actually not about breaking down anything. It's about making relationships. So ecology is the relationship between us, all living organisms, and our environments, the ones that exist in nature and the ones that we build. So when we design ecologically, what we're doing is designing for living relations. We design for ourselves and for the relationships we have to all other species and to our built environment.
Now, when you say designing for ecology, how would you look at that from a built world example? Any projects that you have worked on, or maybe something that you've seen that people can kind of wrap their heads around what's good and bad, maybe?
Well, when we design for the living world, we're designing for survival. That's one way to look at it. Every single decision we make in architecture, in landscape architecture, and engineering ultimately has an effect on us. Even if we don't feel it directly, The planet is our best and only means of survival. And so honoring those connections is the most important thing we can do in the built world. And if you can't see it right away, we can look around us and we can see that anything to do with harnessing the power of the living world in our design is ecological design. So green roofs, bioswales, living walls, wildlife, purpose-built infrastructure that moves wildlife across roads safely. That's one thing we do in our lab regularly. Green roofs and living walls are architectural treatments, but they're also integral to built form fabric. Public spaces on surfaces, underground, parks, public areas, those are all ways of thinking about the natural living world that is also designed, purpose-built by humans for us, but also, most importantly, with respect for the living functions and systems that sustain us. Everything that we can't see, like the nutrient cycle, for example, that is integral to the production of food, that's also part of the living world.
Anything come to mind? You're driving down the street and you see something where you're like, well, that's not going to help our ecology, that people could kind of sort of understand and have a frame of reference on the negative side.
Well, just driving down the road has three things in it right there that are not so helpful for our planetary survival. And that would be the number of people driving individual cars on paved asphalt roads, you know, derived from petroleum fossil fuels. You could think of it very simply that way, although no one in this world is saying that cars can't exist or that roads can't exist. It's about how we use them and perhaps how we think about the road. Let's use the road as an example. It's a good example. Roads are connectors between people. We look at the planet at night and we see the incredible lit planetary surface. You've seen maps, no doubt, that show lighting at night. Those are signs of essentially roads and telecommunications infrastructure that are all about connecting people. So they're really, really good for us in some ways because we're a social species. But on the other hand, every time you see light at night over roadways, what you're doing is fragmenting and breaking up the habitat for all the other creatures on the planet, most of which are ultimately really related to our own survival, whether they'll be food or medicine or just planetary companions. So we think about roads and cars as really opportunities for improvement in how we do our built infrastructure. And we can talk about some examples if you want, but there are lots of other ways to think about architecture in the same way. So I would say that one of the ways we might start thinking is that there's no architecture without the land. It all comes from the land, right? So let's think about our built form. It all comes from somewhere. So having a better relationship between land and water and architecture is a good thing.
Now, I can hear many people in the industry in my head saying, well, how are we going to do the things that we do? It seems like you can't get anything done if you're going down this path of sort of this balance with our ecology and, you know, minimize our impact. How do we build the homes that we do and the buildings that we do? What would you say to anyone from that perspective that's sort of not in alignment with what you're suggesting?
Well, they're making decisions for our children and for our future on our behalf. And I would say that it might be better if we made those decisions together and start thinking about the longer term impact we're having. Not only not the planet. The planet isn't some passive thing that just lies there waiting for us to take. That might appear that way, but ultimately, you think about some of the effects that we're facing around the world. And let me just put it in really super simple terms, because I think that's how we best understand what's happening. We have what many people would call an intersecting series of cascading systems failures around us. We have global heating, otherwise called climate change. We have extinction, biodiversity loss. And we have what many people would call human vulnerability to those cascading effects, or I would call it, in the words of Catherine Hayhoe, human suffering. Those are not good things to have. So when we think about building, one of the things we can do is make sure that the buildings we make address all three of those things to the best extent possible. And it means that they probably would look different in different places. I mean, we're the most dominant species on the planet. We have tremendous power. And we forget sometimes that we're making decisions for everyone, everything around us. And if we're the most dominant species on the planet, and we're also all living in cities now, the majority of human beings are living in cities, I'm sure you come across that statistic a lot, that's a powerful force for shaping the planet's surface. So let's think about how we might be designing our buildings and our cities to engage more constructively with the natural world around us, because it actually sustains us. And we know it's good for us in a number of different ways. We have really good evidence that shows building cities that are nature-filled, the Biophilic Cities movement, for example. This is good for our mental health and for our well-being. You think about what happened during the global pandemic, and we're the only safe place to be with outdoors, and we needed good, healthy public spaces, including in and around our buildings. So that kind of thinking will help us do better for us. It's good for our health. We know that our recovery times in hospitals where we have access to nature or nature-filled space is an improvement for our recovery times. So there's a therapeutic effect as well. And this is not new. It's really well understood science at this point. So designing our buildings in such a way that makes us healthier is a good thing. It's also good for our bottom line. We also know that investing in those opportunities ultimately helps us.
Yeah. And on the LEED and WELL front, for those that are familiar, the LEED, leadership in energy. Oh, I'm going to forget the acronym.
Energy efficiency.
Yes,
like that.
Design. Yeah. And then the WELL design standard. Those both have proven data that shows that this kind of approach does work and it's better for our bottom line. Those buildings resell at higher values. The occupants are much, much happier. So you can look at that data to see those that type of information as well. But I love the point that you brought up of this idea that a lot of us kind of think in this short-term aspect of how we approach design and life in general, and that we have to sort of think more critically about the long-term and the decisions that we make. It's not just about us and the profit that we make right now, because 20 years from now, it's not going to be worth it, whatever money you made at that time. You're basically harming yourself on the back end. And your children, and there's those children. So thinking much more about the long-term effect and a more balanced approach to how we do this. And then one of the other things that you mentioned that I was curious if you had any additional insight into was during the pandemic. I know that there was some data that was shown how nature had kind of bounced back during that time of the lockdown. Did you get any data on that and have any additional insight on how nature sort of recovered during the lockdown and what that could mean as far as how we should extrapolate from that and our approach to how we move forward?
Yeah, that was a really interesting time. A lot of really interesting things happened that were, let's say, unexpected and positive benefits of a pandemic, if I could frame it that way. Keeping in mind that, of course, for millions of people, it was nothing positive about human catastrophe. But what we learned in that period was that as human beings, we're actually very adaptable. We can adapt really quickly when necessary. And it turns out that in some of our ecosystems or the relationships that we have with the living world, there is also the opportunity to adapt. And in fact, my lab doesn't do direct primary research in nature-based recovery. We look at designing infrastructure that supports nature. I would just clarify that. But what we found in the secondary literature, in other words, looking at other studies that we use to support our own work, what we found was that in urban ecology, so urban relationships with nature, if I can use that term broadly, we found that there were really positive outcomes for being able to, for example, renaturalize certain areas of the city that were allowed to perform as, let's say, pollinator pathways, allowing pollinating insects to recover for our food crops, or even turning spaces that had previously just been ornamental, turning them into urban agriculture where people wanted to be outdoors gardening but perhaps didn't have private space to do so. Using our rooftops for urban agriculture, urban pollination, bird habitat even. Those were examples where we saw what I would use Tim Beatley's words here, flourishing, right? It's not just enough to design something to barely survive. That's not anyone's goal. Survival is essential, but I think we hope to thrive and to flourish. And our cities could be designed in such a way that urban habitats, which are our human biggest habitat, they should be flourishing. And yes, that means arts and culture and beautiful buildings, but it should also mean opportunities to flourish with nature. For lots of different reasons, really showed positive mental health benefits. And that to me was one of the most important things. Those were not equitably distributed, of course. So one of the takeaway lessons we learned from the pandemic was that there's a human right, a need to get outdoors and to be in nature for our mental health. And that's particularly so for people in vulnerable communities where perhaps they don't have access to shade trees or beautiful parks, right? These are, you mentioned earlier that people will pay a lot of money for beautiful buildings and beautiful park spaces, or that was the implication. And that's true. Sometimes that's maligned by equity advocates as saying that, you know, nature-based parks are a wealthy asset. Well, that may be true, but they also deserve to be equitably accessed. So I'd always argue that when we're talking about designing with nature in our cities, we want to do so in a way that's equitable and make sure that everyone has the right to the mental health and healing benefits of nature outdoors, but also to its very functional benefits like stormwater amelioration, urban heat island cooling effects as our cities heat up in the summer. So urban shade is a right. Used to be we talked about the right to the sun. Now we talk about the right to shade. So those are also, I would say, some important lessons that we learned during the pandemic, but also things we can take forward into times that where we need adaptation and we need to think creatively to flourish together.
And I think, don't quote me on this statistic, but from memory, I want to say it was estimated that there would be 75% of the population living in urban cities by like 2030 or something, or like something like that. Now, with that influx of people moving into the city, you're going to have a lot of buildings, obviously, to accommodate all of those people. So you tend to run out of this naturalized or natural spaces, where I think biophilic design can maybe alleviate a little bit of that and be sort of a supplement to what we can try to hold on to as far as parks and everything like that. Can you talk a little bit about biophilic design? You mentioned it earlier. Some may not be entirely familiar. Can you talk a little bit about it? And maybe if you have a project that you could reference.
Biophilic design is a term well understood, I think, by architects today, or by many architects, Stephen Keller being one of the earlier architects and authors, Tim Beatley in Planning writes beautifully about the biophilic city. And of course, there is the Biophilic Cities Network, if people are interested to understand different cities around the world that are, I would say, showing, sharing, and leading strategies for designing with nature in cities. So in the broadest sense, it's ecological design, designing with the nature that sustains us and that is here on the planet with us. And in the more specific design, it's integrating those aspects of nature into our built form. Could be architectural, as in green roofs, living walls, green screens, indoor temperature amelioration regulation with plant life, for example. Or it can be really, in my case, looking at the building situated in its landscape, that there is a tight relationship between the two, right? Even though we may have been taught in school as architects and landscape architects that our work is different and they touch each other at certain points, but otherwise, you know, landscape architects see the building as a white box and landscape architects see the figure ground as the building with this white space around it, or whatever, a monochrome space around it. And instead, we would do better if we saw these as integrated. I said before, and maybe architects will find this annoying, landscape architects will cheer, but there is no building without land or landscape. So let's think better together. We can build design in synergy and in ways that we can think about not just bringing the outdoors in, although that might be part of it. It could be something very simple where we know that workspaces that have living plants have different air quality that's usually improved to a certain extent. And more importantly, that people benefit when they see and can touch living plant material. The research that I've seen on plastic plants doesn't actually have that benefit. So that might be an interesting thing to think about. More specifically and more broadly at the same time, I'd encourage listeners to look at projects where the architecture and the landscape are really nicely integrated in a built form that is, for example, for human habitation. So condominiums, apartment buildings, or mixed use retail at grade, where there's an opportunity for building inhabitants, dwellers, or workers to be improving their health outdoors. So that building space around it is not just empty to be filled later with some decorative plants, but rather it's working, functioning landscape for our health. That's a very different way to conceive of the built form in its landscape space. On a specific note, the work that I do has to do with naturalization. So planting areas that are not just turf grass for sitting on, although that's important too, but rather providing a kind of thick diversity of plant and animal habitat around our buildings and through our cities that allow the safe movement for everybody, wildlife at night, perhaps when we don't see it, or even during the day as birds migrate through our cities, but also for people rolling, strolling, jogging, walking, bicycling, that we all have freedom to roam and we can do so in a way that's safe and healthy. That for me is part of the ecological design and part of the biophilic approach to designing buildings and landscapes together. That can be public parks, corridors, greenways, trailways, ravines on the one hand, and it can also be the public spaces around our private buildings that should be designed in tandem. So even something like POPs, privately owned public spaces that are at that edge between where the private building ends and the public space begins, those can be designed with a set of design guidelines that are, for example, LEED specific or that have very specific biodiversity recovery targets for vegetation, pollination, bird life, etc. Those are all things in nature that relate to our health and that not only beautify our cities, but help us flourish.
One of the things that comes to mind for me as far as impediments for nature, the first thing that comes to mind is light. Light that's too intense and obtrusive. What are some other elements that we should be thinking about when we're designing for that healthy movement of nature and people?
That's a great question, Demetrius. Right now, we're talking on the edge of spring migration in the Northern Hemisphere. So birds are just starting to move through our cities. And not surprisingly, just like people do, they love to be along water. As it turns out, water is an essential element for all of us. So just as we have settled our cities on some of the greatest rivers in the world and lakes, we find that birds are not surprisingly attracted to those same places. So many of our cities on the North American flyway, the route that birds take to move back and forth between the Northern and the Southern Hemisphere, they follow the same paths through our cities. And our cities are, of course, in some ways, death traps for birds. Birds can't see glass. They don't perceive it as a barrier. And most of all, it reflects foliage in the sky. And so they tend to fly into it. This is a time when bird losses are devastating. We have lost, for example, almost 30% of our breeding bird population in North America due to collisions with windows. That's something that we know how to prevent. So light is the one thing that we can do. We can turn off lights at night during migration, or at least ameliorate lighting design so that it's down light, not up light. You mentioned that already. We might also think about the benefit of lighting design for our health. It's important for us to see the stars at night, for example. That's philosophically and aesthetically very important for human culture to see the stars. So yes, we can ameliorate lighting. We can think about ways to light safely that are down or that are using a light spectrum that is different for different wildlife. You maybe know this already or have seen this, but in some areas of the world where turtle migration happens around the coast, red lights are used to light the roadways because that actually helps the movement of amphibians and reptiles across roadways. They see in a very different spectrum than we do. And as it turns out, the white lighting can be very disruptive, whereas red lighting is better for them. So those are simple things that we can do in some places. With respect to other aspects that I just mentioned, for birds, we can think about designing our windows and our building screens differently. There's some beautiful, incredible patterns for fritting, for ceramic treatment, for acid etching, for breaking up the reflectivity on our windows that provides safe movement for birds through our cities, which, as it turns out, is important for our mental health. Birdsong is directly connected to a reduction in cortisol levels or stress hormones in humans. We know that birdsong is good for us in so many different ways. And so we don't want to see birds crashing into our windows and dying on our streets. Turns out that architecturally, we can make our buildings incredibly beautiful and varied. It's an opportunity for design, to design with and for the birds. So that's one example. Another opportunity that we might have is to think about ways we stratify urban vegetation, not just lollipop trees and turf grass, right? Turf grass is a crop that is never allowed to seed or to flower. Think about how crazy that is, a crop that is never allowed to be fertile. So we want to think about ways to allow our vegetation to flourish too, that provides habitat and cover for different species across the city, but also for humans can provide rights of ways or thickened edges to our parks and to our private spaces, for example, and at the same time, provide visual cues to caring for a landscape, for pathways through the landscape. Those are all aspects of urban flourishing, I would say, that are important for biophilic design.
Yeah. And I'll say a bird running into the window is a quite traumatic experience firsthand. I think that we have to figure out a way to accommodate that situation. And like you mentioned, it's a very cool design opportunity to get some interesting prints and design aspect to your building rather than just pure glass everywhere. Is there anything else that you would have expected that I would have asked, or anything that you would want to discuss?
Well, let me just say that when we think about architecture, we don't very often think about street design as a connection to architecture. I'm a planner as well as a landscape designer, and I love working with architects to think about the edge of the building as it relates to the street. Lots of architects do. They think about the front door, for example, and how their building reads on the street. I'd argue that the street itself is a kind of architecture. And if we rethink the street for people, as we are doing, for example, in my city with Waterfront Toronto, there's some really fantastic green street designs that, while they are shrinking lanes for cars individually, we're increasing the center median for light rail transit, increasing the footpath, not in a linear way, but actually thickening and widening it to allow for spaces for sitting, bump outs for microforests, parking areas, if you like, for strollers and bicycles, gathering places where the street is becoming a place of slow connection, slowing down, reconnecting. And the streets are in some ways not meant to be just the fastest route from A to B, although that can happen in transit. It's really about an experience of the tree canopy, small parks, granite rock outcroppings, opportunities to sit and reconnect, and also enjoy the built form around us. So when we think about the street, I really encourage architects and designers to think of that too as an architectural opportunity for expression, but also reconnection with the natural world in our cities.
I often talk about this idea of sort of going back to the main street design that we used to have, where you have this mixed-use buildings, housing and residential, or housing and commercial on the first floor, bringing people back to these basically kind of pods where you don't have to have a car all the time. You can walk to the local store, to the local office, or whatever it is. What are your thoughts on that, and maybe how you kind of approach that, both from a planning and landscape side, into integrating into an arrangement more like that?
Well, the main street was a fixture of America. And in fact, I think that as settlement occurred throughout America, there was always a main street where at the five and dime, all of the necessary stores and shops and services were there. People came to the main street. And over time, of course, that changed with the automobile. But now I think we are seeing a yearning for that return. I'm not sure that it's part of a movement of nostalgia, but certainly it's a movement of necessity for health and wellness. And as you pointed out, as our cities will look very different over the next 75 years, as more and more of us cram into them, we're necessarily going to have to rethink our living arrangements, whether that means more intergenerational housing, whether it means cooperative and shared spaces more than we have now, simply because there isn't space for the single family suburban home to exist sustainably. We really have to rethink that. And I think that's not an unfortunate thing. That's an opportunity to rethink what our main streets look like. And maybe what they look like are increasing smaller, finer grained opportunities for mixed use retail, different kinds of living arrangements, upstairs, downstairs. We're living longer. We're also not living in traditional family units all the time. So maybe there are ways, and as some of my colleagues are doing, to think about reorganizing our living for not just intergenerational, but community living as we age, for example. Three or four of us together in an apartment or condo would look very different than a nuclear family. That also means that our main street needs would be different. So anywhere that we can get to by walking, strolling, jogging, or sitting quietly outside under the shade of a beautiful street tree, those are all, to me, aspects of flourishing in a city as we age and also as we densify.
putting on your planner hat, how do you enact that with the infrastructure that we have existing? How do you sort of realistically make that happen?
Well, I think we're seeing that happen in a number of cities out of necessity. I think about the green roof plans, the green streets plans that I've seen from New York, Toronto, Chicago, Vancouver, San Francisco, Washington. There are places that have actually quite progressive plans and designs to make cities more livable. So just turning broadly to the idea of what makes a livable, flourishing city or a biophilic city, those are places where we're starting to see initiatives that focus on transit, focus on walkability wherever possible. And that happens when we have built form that is, you know, has a good planning vision for sure, but also recognizes that those buildings are going to hold more people. And that means we need more access to shared retail, walkability, and transit that is planned. And that can't happen after the fact. So in some areas where we're seeing our manufacturing sites transition to new types of residential, in my own city in Toronto, for example, our waterfront, which used to be industrial, is now turning into commercial institutional residential. It's one of the largest projects in North America that is seeing, you know, 100,000 new people moving into waterfront condominiums, mixed-use retail, small, you know, we've changed the way we design our streets, for example, so that we are thinking about 8 to 12 story buildings made of timber framing, for example. We're returning to timber framed buildings, but using mass timber, for example, cross-laminated mass timber. And that's both an initiative that is intended to be more sustainable with our built materials, but also more, I would say, humane and livable, not just one story above our retail, but 8 to 12 stories. And in certain places where transit nodes exist, not being afraid of density, allowing our towers to go up much higher than we had previously thought to be okay. So those are all changes that we can and are making in some of our biggest cities right now.
Going back to the earlier part of the conversation where we talked about this ecology and sort of dovetailing into this conversation of increased population, the fact that we're so out of whack with our connection to our ecology is creating this global migration, and we're having to accommodate more and more people because they have to get out of these places that are being affected by climate change. Can you talk a little bit about that and kind of what do we see in the future? How do we manage all of this with maybe some of the things that you've been studying and where are we going?
Well, first of all, I'd say that most cities are richer with a greater diversity of people in them. Certainly my own city, Toronto, has benefited enormously from waves of successive in-migration from all around the world. And the diaspora of many, many different ethnocultural identities and populations has done nothing but enrich the city. Our food scene is so much better for it. But, you know, so too, it comes with enormous challenges for affordable housing. For sure, that is probably the single biggest planning crisis around the world in in-migration cities. But we could also learn from how other cities, megacities, are coping with tall buildings. And one of the ways is to be unafraid of density, but to make sure that we mix density with livable space at the ground plane and with green spaces above the ground plane. So that does require some planning, and it requires being unafraid of those challenges in a way that has some foresight to it. So putting some faith in our migration projections. And certainly we have colleagues in the planning and architecture world who are really good at understanding the forces of migration, but also what it means for cities to receive and welcome newcomers in a way that is sustainable and provides for affordable options. Right now, we haven't solved that mix. We have very expensive rents for all kinds of reasons, not least of which I think we allowed a lot of offshore investment into homes that are underused and underoccupied. So I think one of the ways in planning that we're looking at dealing with this is to understand conversions. For example, after the COVID pandemic, our building nature changed. People don't go to the office 5 days a week. We've got these building stocks sitting in our downtown cores that are underused for business, but could be adapted for housing. And to do so in a way that is much more biophilic would be a great thing.
This has been great. I've really enjoyed this. A lot of great little nuggets. Hopefully we can move some people's thought process on how they approach building design and development. thank you so much for the time. For those that would like to follow along with you and your studio, what's the best way to do so?
Please join us. We're at ecologicaldesignlab.ca, or we're on Instagram at ecologicaldesignlabTMU, or me, NM Lister. Really look forward to intersecting and interacting with some of your listeners. I know that together we're going to make things more flourishing and more biophilic.
I'll have those links in the show notes. Thank you to the listeners for listening. We will talk again on the next one. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. Spaces is brought to you by Lines, my Southern California-based architecture and creative studio that provides services focused on custom homes, home renovations, creative office, and specialty retail spaces. Find out more at lines.studio. That's lines.studio. If you learned something from this episode or think it would resonate with a friend, please share it and rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find the show. If you have a question about the built environment or just want to share whatever is on your mind, I'd love to hear from you. You can do that at lines.studio/podcasts. Looking for similar content? Spaces is a proud member of Gable Media, a digital media platform where you can find even more content like this. Visit gablemedia.com, and that's gablemedia.com. And lastly, before I go, if you want to see additional photos, videos, clips, and other content from this episode, visit lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.